Shocking evidence, jury drama, and witness cross-examinations. The Case of podcast takes you inside the biggest trials in the country, reporting the in-depth detail of how courts work and who's in there each week. We've brought you Erin Patterson's mushroom murder trial, the case of Toya's murder in Cairns, a Canberra cold case, the two intruders, and many more. Search for The Case Of, it's on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, I'm Annabelle Crabb. Welcome back to History or Hoarding. Okay, so Maggie's just pressed a button and this whole passageway has just opened up. Tucked away among all the big famous stuff in the library, you know, the books and accoutrements of famous writers and the diaries of big explorers and so on, there's a section deep down in the underground stacks where the flotsam and jetsam of fabulous nobodies reign supreme. Rather magically, this area is called the ephemera section. I went down there for a peek with Maggie Patton.
So ephemera is sort of ephemeral material, pamphlets, flyers, menus, theatre programs, concert programs that sort of disappear.
It's all this stuff that's flimsy, trivial, temporary, unremarkable, the stuff that was supposed to fall through the cracks, only the library didn't let it.
Yeah, we keep it all.
The floor that houses the ephemera section, it's just full of these compactus files with big, wheely kind of opening things. It's like being at sea, isn't it? That you wheel like a ship's wheel to slide the compactus shelves apart. Tiny grey boxes lining from floor to ceiling and find the stuff that's stacked in them.
So you can see there's, let's see, we've got libraries, invitations.
Consumer protection, okay. There are thousands of menus, food you can't order anymore, from restaurants that closed years ago.
The 1930 to 1989 collection of menus.
They keep shopping tags from clothes because maybe one day shopping tags on clothes will be obsolete and someone in the future will want to know what they look like. And so do you go out to find them or do people bring them to you?
Sometimes we go out to find them. Sometimes we do campaigns.
One of the librarians here, wanting to get a sense of what it's like to live in today's economy, collected a year's worth of junk mail, 27 kilos. Ugh, I can't believe how much of it there is. There's a whole collection of fruit stickers. You know the ones you find on apples? They were collected and sent along by a family in Mona Vale in 2009.
What's the goal of having random little things like this that you think people were going to get rid of?
It's our history, and it's our social history, and it's a history of what we're eating and what we're reading and where we're going and how we're gathering. It's really important.
All these little details, they can sometimes feel so insignificant to us. They're just part of the air we breathe, and so often we just let them quietly fall into the rubbish. But if you've ever lost someone, you probably know that those everyday moments, those voicemails that don't say anything, those things that might seem boring now, that's the stuff you miss the most when that person's gone. And so, in a way, the ephemera section and all of today's stories are a love letter to everyday people in ordinary moments.
Because those are the things that, you know, you wouldn't normally see in an auction house or, you know, sold by a book dealer or something like that. So they really fill in layers of society that how else would we ever do that? And that, to me, that's the layer that I want the library's collections to have, is humanity, because it's the State Library of New South Wales. It's people's collection. It's a public collection.
Today, a small but perfectly formed handful of stories. The library finding treasure in other people's trash. And our guide is curator Margot Riley, dumpster diver extraordinaire.
I like the untold stories. I like the small characters, people that no one's ever heard of, people doing things that no one's ever really thought about before.
And the path to these sorts of treasures, these tales of fabulous nobodies, is twisty and it's random, and sometimes it's kissed by sheer luck.
Years ago, I was asked to find something for Valentine's Day.
Uh-oh, right.
And so I thought, okay, Valentine's cards. Oh, we have greeting cards. We have like runs of greeting cards. We have ephemera collections.
So when you're talking about cards that have been written in or
yeah.
not written?
Yeah, no, I've got to be used. And we don't want one of these unused cards.
Right, okay, fair enough. Sorry, I do beg your pardon. And what about, so how many cards?
It's grown, but also too, I don't know that we actively collected greeting cards. They would come in manuscript collections often because, you know, within people's papers, they would, you know, what people are like.
Yeah.
We keep cards, you know. And I don't know whether there was a slight change in philosophy and someone began keeping a lot of the cards. Anyway, so I go down to look for the Valentine's cards and they are arranged by season. So Easter, Christmas, birthday, whatever. And so I find this bunch of Valentine's cards and oh my God, they were amazing because they were all written between one couple.
What?
It was one couple. Snuggle Bunny Frank and Princess Dorothy.
No.
Yes. They were their names for each other. And they were dated. They were amazing. They would have a little date in the corner. So I could actually reconstruct, you know, 40 years of Valentine's cards.
Frank.
I know, and Princess Dorothy. So having done that, I thought, okay, well, they couldn't only have just done Valentine's cards. And because the collection had obviously been split across all these different holidays and birthdays.
That makes me feel a bit panicky, actually.
I know, I was panicky. So I had to get all the boxes up and to go through them all.
Was it like 3 p.m. on a Friday right now?
I think it took me longer than Friday. I could write a book on this one.
I just, out of curiosity, because I'm a person who does tend to disappear down the old rabbit hole myself, I'm just, so your original brief was to
find some Valentine's Day cards.
And was that a request? I'm just picturing the person, like the civilian who's come in and said, I just wanted something, information on Valentine's Day cards. And you've chuffed off down to the stacks and like 2 weeks later you've come steaming back with this story
It was a library request.
Right,
so it was for social media and it was for an event.
Okay, then.
So we
did
a whole a Valentine's Day event about love.
Right.
And we talked about different aspects of the collection. So we had love letters and we had romances. So anyway, the story of Snuggle Bunny, Frank and Princess Dorothy. Anyway, I had to reconstruct this collection. And amongst all of it, I discovered there was a postcard. Someone had actually written to them. So we got their address. So we knew that then what their name was and we knew where they lived. And I managed to track down their nieces. So I got the whole story. I eventually unpacked the entire story of Snuggle Bunny Frank and Princess Dorothy. Through Trove, I was able to actually trace back to the beginnings where Frank had actually been previously married. And in the divorce proceedings, he actually sued for divorce because his wife had not spoken to him. She stopped speaking to him and she just left him notes around the house and would just not be home. She just disappear. So when he met Dorothy, it was the idea that they were counteracting all the negative notes by loving notes. By creating loving messages for each other and every opportunity that they could find. Like if they were separated for a day, a little note would be left or a little card would be written to each other. And they ended up, they were together for, you know, till the end of their lives. And Frank passed away first and then Dorothy went into a nursing home. So in the end, at the end of their lives, my understanding is that these cards would have gone to an opportunity shop after the house was cleared, and that someone has picked up the box and with all the cards.
Quite a remarkable collection.
Brought them to the library. That's the bit we can't, you know, substantiate, but we can't explain any other way.
People who aren't even connected finding something
in an op shop
and thinking,
this is special. This feels... There's something about it.
I can't tell you how moving I find this whole story. I don't know, it's not just the love story of Frank and Dorothy, two fabulous nobodies, but the fact that we know about it only because a random chain of strangers noticed them and recognised something of beauty and value that was unrelated to fame or status or any of the other orthodox commanders of attention. I guess this is kind of the essence of hoarding in history, right? Keeping things that are unique, preserving even quiet stories that would otherwise be lost. Are there some things that just give you great joy that someone has thought to retain them?
Look, I'll have to share another story, another of my favourites, sorry. We know you have to do lots of things when you work in a library, lots of different kinds of things. We were doing a learning event about how to find the history of your house because people love finding out about, you know, how the house has changed over time or what might have been there before. So we're doing this, preparing for the seminar. So I think I put in house hunting or something stupid like that. And up came this little thing saying, oh, yes, house hunting book.
In 1984... the library received a package from a Mr. Chris Sonter, who was an accountant at the Australian Tax Office. He'd worked there his whole career. Dear Sir or Madam, the cover letter read, please find enclosed, in plastic wrap, a small notebook. I obtained the material from the Mittagong rubbish tip when I went to the tip to deposit rubbish. So the notebook that was inside was a handwritten journal recording a young couple's purchase of land in Hurstville in 1913. And it documents their subsequent construction of a weatherboard cottage and a garden. The notebook was accepted into the collection and it was catalogued and sat in the stacks quietly for nearly 40 years until one day when Margot struck it lucky.
I'm like, what's that? So we go down to stack, and again, this little cloth-bound box. I don't know that anybody had ever pulled it off the shelf since. I open it up, and there's this tiny, weeny notebook in it that was all illustrated.
It belonged to a couple, newlyweds, Carl and Gertie Moore, who in 1913 were on a quest to buy some land and build a home together.
Capturing that moment, the excitement of finding their first home. It had everything in it. It had how much they'd paid for their train ticket. And, you know, going down and looking at all the different blocks of land on the corner of these two streets, being able to getting the last block of land.
It has beautiful three-dimensional drawings and plans of exactly what this weatherboard cottage is going to look like with its stripy bullnosed veranda. And every projected expense is lovingly recorded.
Every detail was graphically, like there was a little image, a little drawing.
They're coloured in. The sky outside is featured in a very light blue.
Even the way they paid for the house. The wife had contributed her own money.
And all of the serial numbers of those notes are recorded. International events were kind of rolling on around them as Carl and Gertie expanded into their new block of land and had small triumphs and defeats. In 1913, for instance, elsewhere in Australia, the first stone of Canberra was laid. In France, the Prime Minister resigned with his entire cabinet. King George of Greece was assassinated while out for a walk. He'd refused protection. Carl and Gertie were tussling with tree removals. On March the 30th, they record, tried to remove stumps, went for a walk. This is the sort of detail that doesn't end up in big histories of a country. Who would think to make a record of that? But it's also kind of a fascinating snapshot of time, right? Because when history is recorded not self-consciously or deliberately by historians or reporters, but accidentally as the byproduct of ordinary people living ordinary lives, sometimes you get something more honest.
Moments of just unaltered human existence, I find the most fascinating. The stuff that you know people were writing because it was going to be read tends to bore me.
Like Margot, and like a lot of people who work at the library, Damien Webb's a bit tired of the crown jewels.
The things that are remarkable because they were once owned by a very famous person, or because they're the diaries or letters of a very famous person or very powerful person, sometimes they're a bit more guarded, aren't they, than the diaries and letters of utter nobodies that tell you something a bit more reliable about the time.
And that, to me, is the most magical experiences I get to have in the library, when you can talk to just, I won't say just a random woman, but some woman that you'll probably never see again, and she's coming in and she's going to donate her grandma's journals. And her grandma wasn't the first Aboriginal this or that. She was just a woman that lived out near Bellingen in the 30s and just kept a diary. It wasn't even a particular, she wasn't a civil rights activist. She was just a woman doing stuff. And when you remind people, you're like, that's phenomenal. That is the most valuable thing we could collect. Big history is made up of little history. It's like, yeah, if this collection was just the big dudes, a lot of it's really boring, a lot of it's really dry, a lot of it's self-referential and self-aggrandizing. So when you get the stuff in the gaps, when you start collecting and listening to women, when you start collecting and listening to people with disabilities, to queers, to black people, you suddenly start to see and fill in a lot of these gaps that were left very open and very visibly.
One of the most famous items in the library's collection is Captain Cook's Endeavour Journal. It's the logbook from the voyage that first brought Europeans to Australia. It's capital H history. It's got to be about as far from Carl and Gertie's little house hunting notebook as you could possibly get. But Damien says even the big fancy items can be quite narrowly understood.
I mean, the Endeavour Journal is, it's one of the funniest visual examples we have, because that has been exhibited and loaned so many times. The two-page spread that you open to that looks at the date, which, you know, that late April date, the beginning of the 8 days that they spent around Kamei, it's the only page we've ever opened to. Those two pages have had to be taken out, treated differently and stitched back in of the entire, you know, 500-hour lifetime of that thing being able to be displayed. Those two pages are going to be undisplayable before anything else. And just that we don't even turn the page. The hundreds of times it's been out, it's always been on the same page. And just to me, that visual of they're literally a different colour to the rest of the journal because of the way that light and air has treated it. And most of our rare, fragile material, there's a hard limit. There's only so many hours ever that will be allowed to be under light. And it's literally changed the fabric of the document because we've just looked at this tiny snippet.
That's an extraordinary thought too, the way that you have to ration out these things and decide who can see them and when. I'm interested in this question of value, you know, what we rank as the most important things in the collection. What do you use as a measure of importance when you think about the collection?
I tend to judge the value based on what people can do with it, what it brings to people who come in to read and to look and to listen. I have done some work with acquisitions in a few different libraries. It's a very complicated, very specific thing. And like, yeah, you can make pretty solid arguments about social, cultural, or history based on who the person is, what they're attached to. Like, yeah, that's pretty cool. But once you have to translate that to a dollar figure, the only way you can do that is by going off other dollar figures. So you end up with this kind of weird trail of, well, artworks by that guy cost this much, so this is how much this will cost. And it's a very difficult thing to do, and it is, at the heart of it, a deeply subjective thing that we have added all of these incredibly sophisticated tools and measures and rubrics to. But at the end of the day, it is a decision.
Right.
The reason people think that the First Fleet Journal is the most important thing we have, or Cook's Endeavour Journal, or the Fair Copy, is because we told them that and their grandparents that dozens of times.
This library contains millions of stories, But the biggest story of all is how our ideas, our values, and our idea of what is value change over time. 200 years ago, at its birth, this library was closed to all but the very wealthiest citizens. But over the years, something shifted, and it kept shifting. And now the library kind of belongs to the nobodies. All of them. The students, the homeless, the asylum seekers, the visa workers, the people who come every day and sit with books and might not have anywhere else to be, the people who come for the air conditioning or the free Wi-Fi. And there's never been more of them. Visitors and borrowing rates across Australian libraries have climbed every year for the last 5 years.
In the 90s, everyone said, oh, libraries will die out. No one needs libraries anymore. But they've never been more popular.
Richard Neville, Mitchell librarian, explains that among all the nobodies the library has ever loved, it turns out some of them loved it back. In the way you love a place that's never once asked you to explain yourself.
Do you have visitors who are just there every day and have been for years?
Yeah, there are a lot of those. Some of them we know well. Others just do their own thing. And in fact, one of them, a man called Neville Halls, who none of us really knew, lived in a sort of, not a boarding house, well, probably a boarding house. And just before he unexpectedly died, he changed his will and he left the library $2.3 million. And no one can really remember him, but he'd obviously had a lot to do with us. And he, again, was probably on the margins. And he...
But just happened to have a spectacularly large lump of money.
He seems to have grown up in Bondi, and I suspect his mother may have owned property. But it does kind of, I think it alludes to the fact that for some people, a library is a source of great comfort. People like being with people.
I wonder if Neville Halls ever told anyone exactly what the library meant to him when he was alive. I suspect he probably didn't. He just kept coming. And when he was gone, the only proof of all those hours, all that accumulation of time, was his will, a piece of paper. A whole quiet life, pointing back to this place. And now his story slips quietly into the shelves with all the rest of the fabulous nobodies. Because if the truth be known, libraries hoard us. They keep the Valentine's cards and the junk mail and the tiny notebooks and the difficult doors and the locks of hair. They keep broken shards and deleted emails, all the messy, imperfect, confounding scraps of a nation. Because one day, all these wonky pieces might just find a place in the jigsaw puzzle we haven't finished yet. Thank you so much for your company here on History or Hoarding. I'm off home to not tidy up. History or Hoarding is made on the lands of the Gadigal people. It's written and presented by me, Annabelle Crabb, with research by Julia O'Shea, audio engineering by Harvey O'Sullivan, Rachel Cusick is our supervising producer, and executive producers are Eric George and Carmel Rooney. Head of Audio On Demand is Jessica Radburn. With special thanks to Maggie Patton, Louise Animat, Richard Neville, Damien Webb, Melissa Jackson, Ronald Briggs, Margot Riley, Matthew Burgess, Jim Noble, Rani Haywood, Rawia Jenkins, Jonathan London, and everyone at the State Library of New South Wales who gave their time and shared their awesome stories.